Welcome back to Speaking with Carl Thornton Jr. I am your loyal host, speaking with Mark Pilkington, economic historian and retail expert. And you've done an outstanding job, Mark, of laying the foundation for us, helping us understand how retail got its start. And as we look at that, and you've shared with us the issues surrounding mass production, from there down the supply chain into the stores where markups, plural, took place to the point where we really, really began to have to take a second look at what we as consumers have been paying over the past 250 years for the products that we've been buying. And so it's, we begin to see a change in the way things are being done with regards to the retail industry. But before you take us further into that part of it, could you share with us some more history as you help us take a look at maybe more of the retail end of things, as you share with us some of what was happening with the famed Sears Roebuck and Company, and maybe helping us get a better feel for what was happening on the mass production side of things by sharing with us some things that centered around the Ford empire?
Yeah, well, let's start with the manufacturing, because that's sort of first in the chain. Ford was Henry Ford was a massive contributor to the industrialization program because he was the first guy to realize that you could actually manufacture things on a rolling conveyor belt. So something very complicated like a car, although they could manufacture the individual parts very, very cheaply, Ford was the first to see that if you put it on a conveyor belt and you had a lot of individual work people doing small operations, like just tightening one nut or putting on one piece, and laying them all out in a straight line with an automated rolling platform, with the supply of raw materials being brought to the specific points on the line, as we know it now, this was all revolutionary in the 1910s and 1920s, and he was the guy who really made cars affordable. He was also a great champion for standardization because he understood that standardizing manufacturing enabled one to get the cost down. He had the famous statement that you could have any color so long as it was black, and the Ford Model T was the first really affordable car, and I think he said something like his aim was that Americans could enjoy, ordinary Americans could enjoy the wide open spaces through the use of this less expensive car. So he was a great visionary, and he's definitely one of the ones that managed to get the cost of manufacturing really, really low. So, you know, we look back on him as a kind of hero of the Industrial Revolution. Now, turning to Sears, I mean, what Sears did, along with the other big retailers in that era, in the sort of 1920s, 30s, and 40s, was that they did two things. The first was that they really revolutionized shops by making them much bigger and building them out of town. So, you know, in the early part of the 20th century, most shops were small, and, you know, they were on what we call high streets, what you call main streets. And, you know, that was actually a relatively expensive way of doing shops. And what Sears, amongst some of the other pioneers, did was to take it out of town, build much bigger space, you know, 20,000 square foot spaces, and really combine almost everything, every product category in one space. And, you know, they really sold almost everything. So it was the growth of the big box and the universal choice that was the first thing they pioneered. And there's a very famous statement from Franklin D. Roosevelt, where he was asked what he would give a Russian communist in order to get him to, change his mind about communism. And he said, he thought about it, and then he said, I would give them a Sears Roebuck catalog because, you know, in the Sears Roebuck offer, you know, there was this cornucopia of choice, which, of course, did not exist in Russia to anything like the same extent. That's a funny statement about Sears. The other thing they did, of course, which was pioneering, was that they developed the catalog business, which actually is the forerunner of the internet business, you know, and by doing that, they enabled people in rural areas of the United States to enjoy a much bigger choice of products, even though they couldn't get to big stores because they didn't really have big towns in their areas. They were able to buy via the catalog. But it's a bit ironic, really, now that we see Sears is in fact struggling very badly and very nearly got liquidated a few weeks ago, and actually, you know, didn't develop that catalog business into a big internet business, but ended up, you know, relying just on the stores, which of course has proven to be not a winning strategy in the last 20 years.
So something I'd like to ask you: you mentioned that the retailers were they decided that rather than construct their buildings on High Street, the UK, Main Street, in the USA, they decided to move their constructions out of town. I was just curious, what made that more cost effective for them?
Well, mainly rent, but of course the thing that enabled it was the development of the interstate highway network, and, you know, low gas prices and cheap cars, so people could drive quite long distances to go to the mall or go to the shopping center. You know, it was really driven by very low land prices in those areas, and enabled them to, you know, to cut their costs quite a bit.
Gotcha. So lower land costs, were they also able to more centrally locate their stores by moving them out of town so that more people could get to them quicker?
Well, you know, the thing about, you know, having shops on Main Street, it, depending on the town or the city, is it can be quite congested. So there was a huge move, as I'm sure you're aware, in the sort of late 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, out of town, a lot of people living in the suburbs. Mm-hmm. You know, the city centres became, some city centres became a bit dangerous, and a lot of people moved out of town. So it was a whole social movement. It wasn't just the stores that moved, like a lot of Americans moved.
Gotcha. Okay. So that gives us a good picture of what was happening with mass production as we take a look at what Ford accomplished. Gives us a pretty good picture of what was happening with regards to how we began to get the big box stores, particularly out of town. Now, if you could share with us some more insights about how the retail process works as you share with us some of your own story about your involvement with the Wonder Bra.
Certainly, yes. Well, my involvement with Wonder Bra was in the late 1980s, early 2000s. The Wonder Bra was actually a Canadian product, and my company, Gossard, had licensed it for Europe way back in the 1960s, and it was quite big in the 60s. I don't know whether you're aware. Do you know what the Wonder Bra is?
I do remember some of the commercials.
It was a push-up bra, right? So it gave you a great figure. It was probably, at the time, the best push-up bra in the world. But during the 1970s and early 1980s, there was a whole movement away from the Wonder Bra-type look in the kind of hippie era, where women were burning their bras, and there was a lot of feeling that the Wonder Bra was a slightly artificial contraption that was really to please men. So the zeitgeist was against the Wonder Bra in that period, and so sales dropped off. And in fact, the product was discontinued in Canada and North America, and it only remained in London and a few places in the UK where we had it. And then in the late 1980s and early 1990s, the wind changed again, and we had Madonna and we had the supermodels, and you know, women were in work, in more senior jobs, and they were more confident. And it suddenly became okay to dress in a sexy way again. And that's really where the Wonder Bra started to get back into popularity and was being worn by a lot of models. And they were wearing their mothers, you know, because it had been an old product that had been around forever. And it got noticed by Vogue magazine in London, and they wrote a one-page article about this classic product that was making a huge comeback. We then really pushed the marketing of Wonder Bra in the UK, and we got it in every single newspaper and TV program in the UK. And One thing you should know about the UK is that particularly the newspapers in that era were very, very fond of putting ladies in, you know, not very much clothes in their papers. So the Wonder Bra was a natural product for them to push, and they loved it. So they really, really pushed it, and it became a huge hype in the UK originally. So much so that we completely ran out of stock. And I was a lot younger then, and I had like girls coming up to me in the gym and saying, "Can you get? We understand. We've heard that you're connected with the Wonder Bra. Can you get me one?" 'Cause nobody could get them, which obviously was quite nice at that age. It absolutely exploded. And then we took it into continental Europe first. We launched it in Paris, and we launched it in Italy. We launched it in Germany, and everywhere it went, it became a huge success. And the company grew and grew and grew. It became this kind of monster. It became at one stage, it was in a huge corporation, and it came at one stage like half the profits of this huge corporation were being generated out of this one bra. And it was completely out of step with the rest of the corporation, you know, it was this phenomenon. And then we faced an issue with, because we didn't own it, it was licensed out of Canada, and when it became really, really successful, due to some corporate restructuring and changes, the company in Canada ended up being part of a huge corporation that owned one of our big rivals in Europe. And they decided at the end of 1993 that they were going to take it back. So by this stage, you know, we had tons of factories and, you know, thousands of workers all churning this product out, and suddenly we were going to lose it. So I then had to launch Son of Wonder Bra, which we called Ultra Bra, or in the US it was called Super Uplift, and I then launched that and launched it into Europe. Now, we'd never had the rights to sell Wonder Bra in the States, and although it was in Canada, it wasn't known in America. And as part of that war with our rival company, which, by the way, was called Bra Wars, as you might expect in the UK, while Bra Wars was raging in the UK and Europe, I sneaked over to New York, and I got myself a really fantastic PR agency in New York, and we basically hit it big in the US, and we got it. We did it at some power breakfast hotel in New York, where Henry Kissinger was having breakfast, and suddenly there's all these models coming through in these bras, and we had like 8 or 9 TV crews, and it just went crazy, it went mad, and we had it we launched it with Saks Fifth Avenue, and they had the biggest day they'd ever had with any product launch in Saks Fifth Avenue the day that we launched it. And we went and we were on CNN and we were on NBC and ABC and on all the shows, and I was going through New York with this huge poster of the Wonder Bra all broken down and into pieces, and people were spotting me in the streets and say, it's that bra guy, because they'd seen, you know, it was constantly on CNN. So, you know, we were on all the shows. It was absolutely brilliant. And we then went to Saks, and we'd had a whole wall of this bra, and it was all just wiped out. And there were people coming out, women coming out of the changing rooms and wandering around, dancing around the lingerie department in their bras. And the vice president who I was working with, the Saks vice president, was saying, "You've got to stop them because I'm going to get fired." Because, it was a very conservative society in those days, and they were absolutely not allowed to have people come out of the fitting room. And all the sort of high-ups from Saks were coming down to see what was going on, and it was absolute chaos. And then it went all the way across America, huge thing. So for about 18 months, I got flown all around the States doing promotions and going on shows. It was an extraordinary experience. And we got more coverage in that period than the OJ trial, which was the other huge story that was happening at that time. So it was an absolutely brilliant experience. I love America. Americans are so enthusiastic. And I had a brilliant time just going over. And the funny thing was, we had like one sales guy, because we weren't big in the US. And he was like he was nearly retired. And I think he had a bit of a weak heart or something. And his wife phoned me up one day, and she said, "You're trying to kill Tony because this is just, it got out of hand." Because his phone, we had like only about 50 store distribution in the US, and they were usually mom and pop stores. And suddenly all the big American groups, you know, the Macy's and the Bloomingdale's and Sachs and all these guys, the Nordstroms and the Marcuses, they were all hounding him on his phone saying, we need it, we need it, we need it, you know, and it was going crazy. And he was like just going crazy because it was just him. And he had to go out and hire like 20 people to do all the sales because he just couldn't handle it. But it was an amazing experience. It was fantastic fun.
One of those kinds of problems that you really enjoy having.
Yeah, I mean, it was a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. And it really made my career because I became this kind of corporate hero in my corporate. No one had ever done this kind of thing, you know. It was all quite sort of middle of the road, you know, and suddenly there's all this thing happening. Anyway, that's the story of the Wonder Bra.
And a wonderful story it is. I tell you what,
amazing. Yeah, wonderful to be associated with it. Yeah.
Our guest, everyone, Mark Pilkington, and I will be right back. Stay with us.